In Alabama, a series of deadly assaults shocks the community and frustrates police. All the killers leave behind are the dead and fleeting images on surveillance videotape. Local police and federal agents follow the killer's trail up and down the eastern seaboard. The shadowy fugitives keep running, but the FBI will not give up the chase.
Surveillance video is often the most precise witness to a crime. Its images can speak for victims when they are unable. After three brutal murders were caught on tape in Alabama, the suspects fled the area. They had an arsenal of stolen weapons and swore they wouldn't be taken alive. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. Racing across several states, the fugitives tried to elude the FBI, and agents hoped to capture them without more bloodshed.
In the 1990s, Birmingham, Alabama saw a drop in both its population and its crime rate. But even in the safest cities, killers can strike. On May 18, 1996, a customer at a gas station discovered a body. Birmingham police responded to the 911 call. Crime scene investigators determined the victim, the station cashier, had been shot to death. He was the only employee on duty that day. The customer hadn't seen what happened to him. A trail of blood led back into the store and behind the counter. More blood there indicated the cashier lay briefly on the floor before going outside, perhaps hoping for help. He barely made it to the parking lot. Police first suspected a robbery shooting, but money was left on the counter. And the cash register had not been emptied. No fingerprints pointed toward a suspect. And no witnesses had seen anything. Investigators retrieved the store's security videotape and sent it to the police lab. The tape had degraded because it had been reused many times in the recorder. So the footage of the crime was blurry and few details could be seen. Police technicians tried to clean up the image electronically for detectives. The enhanced tape gave investigators a better look at the crime. It confirmed what the crime scene clues suggested. A lone customer shot the cashier, even though the employee was complying with his demands. It seemed he killed without reason. Technicians made video captures of individual frames and tried to enhance them in order to see the face of the perpetrator or any identifying characteristics. Birmingham police hoped to identify the suspect from the stills. Checking mugshots, they could not find a match. Detectives interviewed friends and relatives of the victim, trying to find some lead on the senseless murder.
Sorry,
No one recognized the killer or knew who might want the cashier dead. Without any other evidence, the investigation stalled. 2 months later, and 20 miles south of Birmingham, a call came into the sheriff's office in Shelby County, Alabama. Sheriff James Jones received the report of two people down at a pawn shop.
We got the phone call. It really wasn't clear to us exactly what had happened. We had reason to believe that lives had been lost in the building. It happened so rarely in our county that I really was surprised when I got on the scene.
EMTs determined the pawn shop owner had died from multiple gunshots. A female employee was in critical condition with a gunshot wound to her head.
All other cars, when you ask that, make sure they...
The sheriff ordered deputies to stop any suspicious vehicles in the area.
We really didn't know what we were looking for at this point. But we was in hopes that our people would be sharp enough, if they saw something that was out of place, that they would be able to recognize that, stop that vehicle, and perhaps give us some leads from it.
Stabilizing her as much as they could in the field, the paramedics prepared the woman for the helicopter ride to the hospital. Authorities determined more than $2,300 in cash and jewelry was missing. And the gun cases had been nearly emptied. Since the pawn shop had frequent customers, it wasn't difficult for crime scene technicians to lift hundreds of latent fingerprints. Connecting one of them to the crime might be impossible. The lead investigator was Shelby County Sergeant Michael DeHart.
There was really a lot of evidence processing to be done, fingerprint dusting, so on, but we didn't find anything definitive as a result of that. The one thing that we did find that we did have were shell casings that were left at the scene.
The murder weapon was a .380 automatic handgun.
At the time, we didn't know if this was a one-time event that had occurred or if this was a part of a larger series of events.
The in-store shooting was similar to the earlier gas station murder, but this crime occurred during a robbery. Detectives checked for the shop's security video. Then they remembered something.
I was talking to the owner a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about putting a dummy machine in. He was talking about putting a real one over in this area.
Sergeant Russell Yawn found the other machine in the actual surveillance videotape.
The second, or the real VCR, continued to operate even after they took and unplugged and removed the tape from the dummy VCR. And it continued to record even until the time that I pushed the eject button.
The videotape showed two young men entering the store at 3:23 p.m. They cornered the shop owner, forcing him behind the counter with the female employee. Deputies spotted a red pickup truck barely visible outside the shop. It might be the getaway vehicle. The suspects looted the pawn shop for 13 minutes while the employees watched. They then shot the hostages point blank.
We saw nothing that told us that these two victims resisted or attempted to resist. They were very compliant. And I'm sure they did that with the hopes that they would live. But instead, their life was taken by execution style. And that was very disturbing to see that.
What I don't understand is, this is just garbage.
Sergeant Yawn and his partner, garbage. Sergeant Donald King, found more evidence near the spot where the victims had been killed.
As we were doing our search at the pawn shop, we saw a small pile of garbage in behind the counter, and we noted it at the time. Why was the garbage there? There was no garbage can. It really didn't make a whole lot of sense at the time. There was also some metal filings on the floor mixed in with the trash.
The filings likely came from a key-making machine installed on the counter. Detectives collected them for later examination. They believe the killers took the garbage can, but they didn't know why. Federal law requires that anyone buying or selling firearms must keep records of the transactions. Detectives asked another employee to bring up the store's weapons manifest, comparing it to the guns still in the shop.
Yeah, I think this is,
They realized the suspects took an entire arsenal.
Yeah, I think that's it.
There were 32 stolen weapons in the hands of vicious killers.
We was very disturbed about what else would they do, what were they doing now, and what would they do again in the future.
Because of the potential for more violence by the heavily armed killers, sheriff's detectives immediately contacted the Shelby County District Attorney's Office. Prosecutor Randy Hillman joined the investigation.
We'd like to be in on the front end of any investigation. It makes things a lot easier for us. It makes things a lot easier for the police officers working the scene as well.
The surveillance videotape was the best evidence investigators had to find the killers. It showed the suspects carry out many of the stolen items in a guitar case. One of them shot both the shop owner and the employee. At one point, his gun jammed. Almost mechanically, he cleared and reloaded, and then kept firing. The two suspects got into the waiting red pickup, both on the passenger side. There must have been a driver, a third suspect. Technicians made photos from video captures, but the quality was poor.
We had photographs of these individuals actually doing the execution. We had a partial photograph of the vehicle that they were in, but we didn't know who they were. And the level of violence here was critical to us. I mean, we had to stop these guys before it happened again.
Less than 8 hours after the shooting, investigators learned the pawn shop employee died in the hospital. Now there were two innocent murder victims. Technicians at the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences examined the bullet fragments and casings found at the pawn shop. They compared them to those used in other area shootings, including the one at the Birmingham gas station, to see if the same gun was used. But the pawn shop bullets did not match any others. Still, investigators thought the two crimes might be related. They turned to the public for help.
We were able to distribute still photographs to the local media in the area, and we enlisted their assistance in getting the pictures out there to the public and to request assistance in identifying the perpetrators of these crimes.
They kept several aspects of the crime secret to help identify more reliable leads.
What's the address on Commerce Street? Okay.
The media exposure generated dozens of calls.
Okay, how many guys were there?
One caller said that while driving in Birmingham, he saw two men fitting the description of the pawn shop killers. They were carrying guns and a guitar case from a red pickup into a house. The detail of the guitar case had been withheld from the public.
Okay, great.
The caller said he knew the men, but only by their street names,
okay.
Turkey and Maine.
Hey, Mike, we just got some...
Shelby County detectives took the information to Birmingham police.
Got an informant calling with two guys loading up...
The Metro Department had a database on street names.
Teams about...
Turkey was an alias for 16-year-old Marcus Presley. He resembled the shooter in the pawn shop murders. Maine was 18-year-old LeSamuel Gamble. He resembled the second pawn shop robber. The two had long juvenile records.
go into the areas where the information indicates.
Through court documents, they learned where Gamble lived.
We knew that the people that we were looking for were very dangerous men. They had killed before. We were afraid that they would kill again. And so when we undertook these searches, we wanted to use every safety precaution available to us. So we used tactical dynamic entries into the residences that we searched.
Sheriff's have a search warrant!
The arrest team cleared the house where Gamble had been living. No one was home.
Nobody in the house?
Nobody?
A pair of cold-blooded killers with an arsenal of stolen weapons remained on the loose.
Everybody's inside. We'll set up a perimeter.
Okay. Thank you. Not seen any movement?
On July 28, 1996, Alabama investigators searched for Marcus Presley, LeSamuel Gamble, and a third suspect believed to be involved in a double murder at a pawn shop. A tactical arrest team entered the house where suspect Gamble lived, but they found no one there. Armed with a warrant, detectives searched the house. Shelby County Sergeant Russell Yawn recovered evidence that directly linked the suspect to the pawn shop murders.
During the search, we found the videotape that came from the dummy VCR. It was destroyed, the case was cracked and broken, the tape pulled from the housing, and it indicated to us that they were aware that they were being recorded, and they had the presence of mind to stop and try to remove or eliminate all evidence of their crime.
They also found an empty guitar case. It appeared to be the one taken from the pawn shop. Sergeant Donald King found more evidence in the kitchen.
We were able to find a garbage can, and in the bottom of it had some labels, some price tags and so forth from some of the guns and some of the jewelry from the pawn shop. And it also contained some of the same metal shavings that we were able to tie back to the robbery scene.
Sergeant Michael DeHart was frustrated that they didn't find any of the 32 stolen weapons.
At the time that we did the search, we knew that three people were involved, but the third person we didn't know. When we did the search at the residence, we found a paycheck stub in a coat pocket that had the name Stephen McKenzie on it from a business in the Boston area.
So, paycheck stub.
Perhaps McKenzie was the third suspect who drove the getaway vehicle.
Dated fairly recently.
He had no local address, but neighbors said he was a friend of Gamble and Presley. Court records listed Marcus Presley as living with his grandmother.
There's nothing here that can directly be tied to the pawn shop.
Investigators searched that house too, but found nothing there that related to the crime.
That's 10-4, 1230 3rd Avenue West.
Presley's grandmother arrived home as they were executing the search warrant.
Yes, ma'am. We got a search warrant to search this residence.
Can I go in my house?
Not right now. We're doing an investigation of the robbers, but you can speak to these two people right here.
Ma'am, I'm Chris Curry with Shelby County Sheriff's Office.
Detective showed her video captures from the robbery.
Tell me if you recognize any two people.
She admitted one of the men looked like her grandson.
Help us and tell me if you recognize anyone.
She had tried her best to raise Marcus, but he got involved with drugs and gangs and had been in trouble ever since.
Thank you very much. You've been very helpful. And again, I apologize for the inconvenience.
She said he would disappear for weeks at a time.
But it will take him a few more minutes to finish.
She was devastated to learn that now he was a murder suspect.
You are certainly welcome to sit on the porch if you like.
The suspect's apparently constant movement troubled prosecutor Randy Hillman.
They were young, they were mobile, they didn't have any home base that they operated out of like normal people have a home that they go to and from. They had several different residences that they would frequent.
Detectives canvassed the neighborhood where Gamble and Presley hung out, interviewing anyone who might know the suspects. Several people in the neighborhood said that lately, Gamble and Presley had been flashing jewelry and giving away guns to members of their street gang.
That's enough guns to supply an army.
Some said they heard the suspects were still in the area and offered addresses where the young men might be staying. The detectives checked all the addresses. Gamble and Presley seemed to have disappeared.
We had one last place that we wanted to look before going home that particular day. We were on the way back, and the suggestion was made, let's ride by the uncle of LaSamuel Gamble. Let's ride by his house and just see if anyone's there. We did that, and when we did, we saw a red pickup truck that matches the description of the vehicle that was used in the robbery.
It had no plates, but they could see the vehicle identification number. The detectives noticed a Massachusetts parking permit in the corner of the windshield.
6802746.
They hoped Gamble's uncle would have information about the suspects. The uncle agreed to answer their questions, but not at his home. He did not want to be seen with the cops. They took a drive so they could talk. The uncle told investigators that the truck belonged to Stephen McKenzie, a friend of his nephew. It was the same name as the one on the Boston pay stub. The uncle admitted that his nephew recently stayed at his house with McKenzie and Presley. The trio had cleared out several days ago. Sergeant Yawn believed the uncle knew details.
And at first, he really didn't want to give us any useful information, but we continued, and he did admit that they had left town and they had gone to Boston.
A check of the red pickup's Massachusetts parking permit confirmed that the truck belonged to Stephen McKenzie, the suspected getaway driver.
Everything going okay?
Eventually, the uncle gave investigators permission to search his property. He suggested they look under the porch. There, police found a paint gun. The serial number on the gun matched one taken from the pawn shop. There was enough probable cause to impound McKenzie's pickup and process it for evidence. But the technicians did not find anything that tied it to the pawn shop robbery homicide. With the possibility that the suspects had left the state, Shelby County authorities contacted FBI Special Agent Jeff Newton.
They requested FBI assistance in locating suspects that they had identified as they believed to be responsible for this terrible crime. At that point, I got information from the case from the Sheriff's Department representative, realized that we had enough probable cause at that point to apply for a federal unlawful flight to avoid prosecution or UFAP warrant.
The FBI re-interviewed the suspect's friends. They told agents Gamble and Presley were acting desperate and volatile, and that the pair had promised, if the law ever caught up with them, they would not be taken alive. In Alabama, authorities struggled to find the men believed responsible for two robbery homicides. The state increased the reward for the capture of LeSamuel Gamble, Marcus Presley, and Stephen McKenzie to $100,000. FBI Special Agent Jeff Newton believed the suspects left Alabama for Boston.
Anybody who's a suspect in a double homicide is automatically rated at the highest priority. I immediately notified our Boston office, you got bad guys heading your way, we believe, or may already be there. I gave them lots of details, everything I learned from Shelby County pertaining to their level of violence, you know, what they look like. We were sending photographs, we were sending full physical descriptions.
At the Boston, Massachusetts FBI field office, Special Agent Joseph Altman received the priority call.
The three individuals were identified to us as vicious killers, that they had made claims to the effect that they would not hesitate to kill again, that they would not be taken alive, or that they would take the life of any law enforcement officer that attempted to stop them.
Birmingham agents also sent Boston a list of places they should investigate. One was the construction company where suspect Stephen McKenzie had worked. Agents went to speak with the owner. The man said he had not seen the suspect in weeks. If McKenzie was in the Boston area, he had not made an attempt to come back to work. The owner had an employment record, but it did not contain any new address or other information that would help find the suspect. Boston authorities staked out the other addresses that Birmingham had sent, including one of another uncle of LeSamuel Gamble. But they did not approach this house immediately.
We did not want to let on that we were surveilling this particular home. We wanted to allow at least one or two areas, homes, and then the area that they could return to.
After several hours, they spotted a man leaving the residence.
Looks like him, yeah.
It was not one of the suspects. They waited until they were sure he was alone and not being watched.
How you doing, sir? I'm Special Agent Daniel and Special Agent Frenzel. We'd like to ask you a couple questions if we could.
All right.
Do you live in that building?
He was hesitant to talk, but did say that neither Gamble's uncle nor the suspects were in the house.
No, someone's in there?
No, Marcus Presley.
But he had seen them.
Thank you very much. Again, we just have to ask him.
He told us that both Gamble and Presley had been staying at this location, but they had since moved out. He did not know where they moved to. We felt that this location was no longer vital in our investigation, so we obtained a search warrant and searched the home and did not discover anything of lead value.
Another address on their list was in Roxbury, a suburb south of Boston. An agent set up surveillance there. It meant more long hours with no promise of a payoff. On August 1st, 1996, the Boston FBI held a press conference.
We believe these individuals to be extremely dangerous, most likely armed. They're wanted in Alabama. We'd like to bring these individuals in.
They distributed wanted posters and asked anyone with information to call a special tip line.
Hey,
Hey, what's up?
The media campaign produced dozens of leads. One was an address outside Boston, where alleged getaway driver Stephen McKenzie was said to be staying. There was no word whether Gamble and Presley were with him. The tactical arrest team had to be prepared for a fight. They caught McKenzie off guard. But Gamble and Presley were nowhere to be found. The two fugitives remained free and on the streets with an arsenal of stolen weapons. In August of 1996, a Boston SWAT team arrested one of three suspects who had fled Alabama after two robbery homicides. The suspected getaway driver, Stephen McKenzie, was unarmed and taken in for questioning.
Good work, guys.
Thanks. Investigators searched the house where he was staying. They found jewelry, later determined to be from the Alabama pawn shop that was robbed. They also recovered three weapons. Running the serial numbers of the guns, agents learned they were among the 32 weapons stolen from the pawn shop. But nothing in the house indicated where LeSamuel Gamble and Marcus Presley were. Boston agents held McKenzie on a charge of receiving stolen property. They contacted prosecutor Randy Hillman in Shelby County, Alabama.
Immediately after receiving that telephone call, we got on a plane and flew to Boston to help the Boston investigators.
They hoped McKenzie could lead them to the elusive armed killers.
We knew the level of violence and the numbers of guns that they had and what a danger they posed. To other people.
The Shelby County authorities interviewed McKenzie.
Mr. McKenzie, you know why we're here. Our major concern is that these weapons are going to get back out on the street and someone else, innocent persons, are going to lose their lives.
They confronted him with the evidence they had. Hoping for sentencing leniency, the suspect began to talk.
We're sitting around or whatever and drinking.
He said that he, Presley, and Gamble planned the pawn shop robbery in mid-July. They drove by the shop to check it out. Gamble said it would be a good place to rob. There were guns, jewelry, and cash inside, and no security.
I'm positive. It was guaranteed that, you know, no one would get hurt. It was just a in-and-out thing.
On July 25th, they returned in McKenzie's pickup. Gamble and Presley went inside while McKenzie waited. They were only supposed to grab the money and valuables. But then McKenzie heard shots. They took what they came for, then fled. McKenzie said Gamble and Presley had run with him to Boston.
I don't know.
and that they might still be in the area somewhere. Investigators were unconvinced.
He's not a bad fellow.
That's right. We'll let him sit in for a while.
He claimed that he did not know where they were at the time, which I don't know that he did. He did give us some information about where they had been staying, the different houses that they may have gone to, and some other information. I think McKenzie held out on us. I think McKenzie knew more than what he was telling us. At trial, McKenzie's testimony would be attacked. The prosecutor turned to the one unimpeachable witness, the surveillance video. He sent the tape to the FBI's audio and video processing lab in Quantico, Virginia. The task of cleaning up the footage fell to video program manager Dale Linden.
This tape was a VHS recording on a security system. It had, I would say, fairly poor quality as far as resolution. It had a backlighting issue where the camera was facing towards the windows. At some point, some of the people in this video scene looks like silhouette. As people moved around, the closer they got to the camera, the better images we were able to retrieve.
Focusing on the portions of video where the perpetrators were nearest the camera, Linden began enhancing the images.
Once we digitize these images, we will go through each one. And depending on what the problems are, we will apply different types of filter processes. In this particular case, the first thing we did was we did some contrast adjustments to make the images look brighter and focusing in primarily on the subjects. In this particular case, I felt that we did some improvement to get facial detail of the face and the weapons and also their movements within the store itself.
The results strengthened the case against Gamble and Presley. Now authorities needed to catch them. The FBI continued their stakeout at a house in Roxbury, Massachusetts, where informants said the men might hide out. It was the best lead so far for FBI Special Agent Joseph Altman.
We surveilled this house for approximately 48 hours. The street information that we had was getting better and better all the time that the individuals were holed up in this house. We thought that we saw movement in the house.
Are they ready? This is Special Agent Frasker. SWAT ready?
Field agents told the SWAT team to prepare for entry. Right before the go word was given, a man left the target house.
Excuse me, sir.
Agents believed it was Gamble's uncle. They knew he was on probation for a felony offense. In accepting probation, a person gives up his Fourth Amendment rights. He can be stopped and searched at any time.
Oh, that's what we wanted to find out. Why don't you put them in this procedure? This all right. I don't care about your cousin. Gun!
Agents found a handgun.
This was one of the weapons that was actually stolen during the robbery in Alabama, one of the 32 weapons that were stolen. He told us that the subjects were no longer in this house. However, we felt that since he was related to the subjects, and that he had a stolen weapon on him, that we could not take this information at face value. So Boston SWAT went ahead and made the entry.
Gamble and Presley had sworn never to be taken alive. So the SWAT team prepared for a shootout.
We felt that the only way that they were going to be extricated from the house was through force.
The tactical arrest team swept through the house, clearing each room as they went.
Right.
clear.
No one was inside.
However, they did find some travel bags belonging to Presley and Gamble. Inside these bags were a couple of weapons, in addition to a photograph.
The photos showed the fugitives getting on a bus. The travel bags contained the shirts worn by Gamble and Presley at the pawn shop. Investigators also recovered one of the guns used in the pawn shop robbery.
Thank you, officer. Thank you very much. Come on.
The uncle confirmed Gamble and Presley stayed at the house.
I found these pictures in there.
He said they left on a bus for Virginia, where Gamble's girlfriend lived.
Okay.
The FBI and Boston police had missed the dangerous fugitives by a matter of hours. On August 5th, 1996, fugitives LeSamuel Gamble and Marcus Presley eluded an arrest team in Boston. An uncle told agents the men had left for Virginia, where one had a girlfriend, but he did not know exactly where. To narrow the search, the FBI obtained the phone records of houses in Boston where the suspects might have stayed. For nearly 48 hours, agents combed through the records, looking for common numbers. According to FBI Special Agent Joseph Altman, they found one.
We did find a common phone numbers that occurred about 2.5 months before the murders took place and about a week after the murders took place.
The number was in the Norfolk, Virginia area. Boston agents contacted the FBI's Norfolk field office. On August 8th, Special Agent John Harley received word from Boston to apprehend the young fugitives.
Youth can be a factor in making somebody a little bit more unpredictable. If they're older and more set in their ways, they may even have a past pattern of conduct that we can look at and help us in apprehending that person. But with these two individuals, as young as they were, they proved to be very difficult because they were not predictable at all.
At 5:30 the next morning, the fugitive task force arrived.
You alone in there?
An individual came to the door who we weren't sure matched the description or not initially, but we went ahead and detained him there at the door and asked if we could go ahead and consent to search his apartment, at which time he said we could.
See these guys? You haven't seen them before?
The resident recognized photographs of the suspects.
The individual who he talked to provided us information that he had had a party recently at his apartment and that two individuals matching the description of Presley and Gamble had come with a girl that he knew.
The place was empty, but the resident gave agents the girl's address.
Time is starting to tick by, and we then have to head over to try to locate this apartment where this girlfriend is apparently living, who's associated with the two subjects.
An arrest team quickly assembled outside the target apartment, a third-story residence. Norfolk police helped cordon off the area while agents assessed the building for entry.
It's now getting to be about 9 o'clock in the morning. The sun's up now, and we were getting concerned that if the two subjects were sleeping, that they weren't going to be sleeping for very much longer, and we would prefer to go in if they were obviously not awake.
The arrest team split into two groups and moved in.
We decided to make our main effort use the most people to go up the fire escape, which isn't the most conducive route, but it was the route that we thought offered the most surprise. We also then stationed two special state police agents on the front door, which would have been in the interior hallway, just to make sure that any bad guys didn't run out.
The agents did not have the time to obtain a search warrant for the apartment. To get inside and make a legal arrest, they would have to see the suspects or get permission. They spotted a resident through a back window and took a risk.
We announced to him who we were and that we were looking for a couple of individuals and asked if he minded if we took a look around. This older gentleman then stepped aside, nodded, come on in, and that's when we made our entry.
They found Presley first.
We immediately handcuff him and detain him.
He had no opportunity to warn his friend. In a rear bedroom, the team found Gamble. The agents positively identified Presley and Gamble from photographs and placed them under arrest. U.S. Marshals transported the fugitives back to Shelby County, Alabama. When questioned at the county jail, Samuel Gamble blamed Presley for the murders. When they spoke to Marcus Presley, he had a different story. Each believed they had destroyed the surveillance tape.
Presley and Gamble both still thought that there was nobody alive from the robbery who could say exactly what happened. They continued to point the finger at each other, saying, he's the one that did it, or it wasn't me, it was someone else, until they saw the videotape. Once they saw the videotape, they realized that no longer could they lie about it, that we had them actually doing the executions. And the whole tenor of the conversation changed then. Eventually, Marcus Presley, after pointing the finger several other places, Presley confessed and said that he did do the killing.
How about this for you?
Presley also confessed to another crime. He had been the shooter in the gas station murder in Birmingham. He said he thought the cashier was going for a gun, so he shot him. In 1997, the three suspects had separate trials. For his role, Stephen McKenzie received 50 years. An Alabama jury convicted Samuel Gamble of capital murder and sentenced him to death for being part of the pawn shop slayings. Marcus Presley received the death penalty for killing the gas station cashier. Another jury sentenced him to death a second time for killing the pawn shop employees.
When the jurors saw this tape, they were shocked. People are used to seeing violence on television, and we've seen so much of it that you kind of become detached, that it becomes old hat to you. This was an actual videotape of two people being executed, and it had a profound impact on the jury. Actually, the owner of the pawn shop was an unwitting participant in the investigation of his own murder. By having the dummy VCR and putting that tape in our hands, showing the actual executions, he helped us solve this case a lot more quickly and with conviction, with absolute certainty. Whereas if we hadn't had this tape, it would have been a guessing game.